it is difficult not to sense that they're unhappy or frightened, even if it's some rudimentary version of these feelings. And again, why does rudimentariness even enter into it? Why is a primitive, inarticulate form of suffering less urgent or uncomfortable for the person who's helping to inflict it by paying for the food it results in? I'm not trying to give you a PETA-like screed here, at least I don't think so. I'm trying, rather, to work out and describe some of the troubling questions that arise amid all the laughter and saltation and community pride of the Maine Lobster Festival. The truth is that if you, the festival attendee, permit yourself to think that lobsters can suffer and would rather not, the MLF begins to take on the aspect of something like a Roman circus or medieval torture fest. Does that comparison seem a bit much? If so, exactly why? Or what about this one? Is it possible that future generations will regard our present agribusiness and eating practices in much the same way we now view Nero's entertainments or Mengele's experiments? My own initial reaction is that such a comparison is hysterical, extreme, and yet the reason it seems extreme to me appears to be that I believe animals are less morally important than human beings, meaning a lot less important, apparently, since the moral comparison here is not the value of one human's life versus the value of one animal's life, but rather the value of one animal's life versus the value of one human's taste for a particular kind of protein. Even the most diehard carnophile will acknowledge that it's possible to live and eat well without consuming animals. And when it comes to defending such a belief, even to myself, I have to acknowledge that, A, I have an obvious selfish interest in this belief, since I like to eat certain kinds of animals and want to be able to keep doing it, and B, I haven't succeeded in working out any sort of personal ethical system in which the belief is truly defensible instead of just selfishly convenient. Given this article's venue and my own lack of culinary sophistication, I'm curious about whether the reader can identify with any of these reactions and acknowledgments and discomforts. I am also concerned not to come off as shrill or preachy when what I really am is more like confused. For those gourmet readers who enjoy well-prepared and presented meals involving beef, veal, lamb, pork, chicken, lobster, etc., do you think much about the possible moral status and probable physical suffering of the animals involved? If you do, what ethical convictions have you worked out that permit you not just to eat, but to savor and enjoy flesh-based viands, since of course refined enjoyment, rather than mere ingestion, is the whole point of gastronomy? If, on the other hand, you'll have no truck with confusions or convictions, and regard stuff like the previous paragraph as just so much fatuous navel-gazing, what makes it feel truly okay, inside, to just dismiss the whole thing out of hand? That is your refusal to think about any of this the product of actual thought, or is it just that you don't want to think about it? And if the latter, then why not? Do you ever think, even idly, about the possible reasons for your reluctance to think about it? I am not trying to bait anyone here. I'm genuinely curious. After all, isn't being extra aware and attentive and thoughtful about one's food and its overall context part of what distinguishes a real gourmet? Or is all the gourmet's extra attention and sensibility just supposed to be sensuous? Is it really all just a matter of taste and presentation? These last few queries, though, while sincere, obviously involve much larger and more abstract questions about the connections, if any, between aesthetics and morality, about what the adjective in a phrase like the magazine of good living is really supposed to mean, and these questions lead straight away into such deep and treacherous waters that it's probably best to stop the public discussion right here. There are limits to what even interested persons can ask of each other. The view from Mrs. Thompson's. Location, Bloomington, Illinois. Dates, 11 to 13 September 2001. Subject, obvious. Part 1, Synecdoche. In true Midwest fashion, P. People in Bloomington aren't unfriendly, but do tend to be reserved. A stranger will smile warmly at you, but there normally won't be any of that strangerly chit-chat in waiting areas or checkout lines. But now, thanks to the horror, there's something to talk about that overrides all inhibition, as if we were somehow all standing right there and just saw the same traffic accident. Example, overheard in the checkout line at Burwell Oil, which is sort of the Neiman Marcus of gas station convenience store plazas, centrally located athwart both one-way main drags and with the best tobacco prices in town, it's a municipal treasure. Between a lady in an Osco cashier smock and a man in a dungaree jacket cut off at the shoulders to make a sort of homemade vest. Quote, with my boys, they thought it was all some movie like that Independence Day, till then they started to notice how it was the same movie on all the channels. Close quote. The lady didn't say how old her boys were. Part 2. Wednesday. Everyone has flags out. Homes, businesses. It's odd. You never see anybody putting out a flag, but by Wednesday morning, there they all are. Big flags, small, regular flag-size flags. A lot of homeowners here have those special angled flag holders by their front door, the kind whose brace takes 4 Phillips screws. Plus thousands of those little handheld flags on a stick you normally see at parades. Some yards have dozens of these stuck in the ground all over, as if they'd somehow all just sprouted overnight. Rural road people attach the little flags to their mailboxes out by the street. A good number of vehicles have them wedged in their grill or attached to the antenna. Some upscale people have actual poles. Their flags are at half-mast. More than a few large homes around Franklin Park or out on the east side even have enormous multi-story flags hanging gonfalon style down over their facade. It's a total mystery where people can buy flags this big or how they got them up there or when. My own next-door neighbor, a retired bookkeeper and U.S. Air Force vet whose home and lawn care are nothing short of phenomenal, has a regulation-size anodized flagpole secured in 18 inches of reinforced cement that none of the other neighbors like very much because they feel it draws lightning. He says there's a very particular etiquette to having your flag at half-mast. You're supposed to first run it all the way up to the finial at the top and then bring it halfway down. Otherwise, it's some kind of insult. His flag is out straight and popping smartly in the wind. It's far and away the biggest flag on our street. You can also hear the wind in the cornfields just south. It sounds roughly the way light surf sounds when you're 2 dunes back from the shore. Mr. N's pole's halyard has metal elements that clank against the pole when it's windy, which is something else the neighbors don't much care for. His driveway and mine are almost right together, and he's out here on a stepladder polishing his pole with some kind of special ointment and a chamois cloth. I shit you not. Although in the morning sun it's true that his metal pole does shine like God's own wrath. Hell of a nice flag and display apparatus, Mr. N. Ought to be. Cost enough. Seen all the other flags out here everywhere this morning? This gets him to look down and smile, if a bit grimly. Something, isn't it? He says. Mr. N is not what you'd call the friendliest next-door neighbor. I really only know him because his church and mine are in the same softball league, for which he serves with great seriousness and precision as his team's statistician. We are not close. Nevertheless, he's the first one I ask. Say, Mr. N., suppose somebody like a foreign person or a TV reporter or something were to come by and ask you what the purpose of all these flags after what happened yesterday was, exactly. What do you think you'd say? Why, he says after a little moment of him giving me the same sort of look he usually gives my lawn, to show our support and empathy towards what's going on, as Americans. Plus, selected other responses from various times during the day's flag hunt, when circumstances permitted the question to be asked without one seeming like a smartass or loon. Quote, to show we're Americans and we're not going to bow down to nobody. Quote, it's your basic pseudo-archetype, a reflexive semion designed to preempt and negate the critical function. That was a grad student. Quote, for pride. Quote, what they do is symbolize unity and that we're all together behind the victims in this war and they fucked with the wrong people this time, amigo. The overall point being that on Wednesday here, there's a weird accretive pressure to have a flag out. If the purpose of displaying a flag is to make a statement, it seems like at a certain point of density of flags, you're making more of a statement if you don't have a flag out. It's not totally clear what statement this would be, though. What if you just don't happen to have a flag? Where has everyone gotten these flags, especially the little ones you can fasten to your mailbox? Are they all from the 4th of July and people just save them, like Christmas ornaments? How do they know to do this? There's nothing in the Yellow Pages under flag. At some point, there starts to be actual tension. Nobody walks by or stops their car and says, "Hey, how come your house doesn't have a flag?" But it gets easier and easier to imagine them thinking it. Even a sort of half-collapsed house down the street that everybody thought was abandoned has one of the little flags on a stick in the weeds by the driveway. None of Bloomington's grocery stores turn out to stock flags. The big novelty shop downtown has nothing but Halloween stuff. Only a few businesses are actually open, but even the closed ones are now displaying some sort of flag. It's almost surreal. The VFW hall is obviously a good bet, but it can't open until noon, if at all. It has a bar. The counter lady at Burwell Oil references a certain hideous, quick-and-easy convenience store out by I-55, at which she's pretty sure she recalls seeing some little plastic flags back in the racks with all the bandanas and NASCAR caps. But by the time I get out there, they all turn out to be gone, snapped up by parties unknown. The cold reality is that there is not a flag to be had in this town. Stealing one out of somebody's yard is clearly just out of the question. I'm standing in a fluorescent-lit quick and easy, afraid to go home. All those people dead, and I'm sent to the edge by a plastic flag. It doesn't get really bad until people come over and ask if I'm okay, and I have to lie and say it's a Benadryl reaction, which in fact can happen. And so on until, in one more of the horror's weird twists of fate and circumstance, it's the quick and easy proprietor himself, a Pakistani, by the way, who offers solace and a shoulder and a strange kind of unspoken understanding, and who lets me go back and sit in the stockroom amid every conceivable petty vice and indulgence America has to offer and compose myself, and who only slightly later, over styrofoam cups of a strange kind of perfumey tea with a great deal of milk in it, suggests construction paper and, quote, magical markers, which explains my now beloved and proudly displayed homemade flag. Part 3. Aerial and Ground Views. Everyone here gets the local news organ, the pantograph, which is roundly loathed by most of the natives I know. Imagine, let's say, a well-funded college newspaper co-edited by Bill O'Reilly and Martha Stewart. Wednesday's headline is Attacked. After two pages of AP stuff, you get to the real pantograph. Everything to follow is verbatim. Wednesday's big local headlines are Stunned Citizens Run Through Many Emotions, Clergy Open Arms to Help People Deal with Tragedy, ISU Professor Bloomington Normal Not a Likely Target, Prices Rocket at Gas Pumps, Amputee Gives Inspirational Speech. There's a half-page photo of a student at Bloomington Central Catholic High School saying the rosary in response to the horror, which means that some staff photographer came in and popped a flash in the face of a traumatized kid at prayer. The op-ed column for September 12th starts out, "The carnage we have seen through the eyes of lenses in New York City and Washington, D.C. still seems like an R-rated movie out of Hollywood." Bloomington is a city of 65,000 in the central part of a state that is extremely, emphatically flat, so that you can see the town's salience from way far away. Three major interstates converge here, and several rail lines. The town's almost exactly halfway between Chicago and St. Louis, and its origins involve being an important train depot. Bloomington is the birthplace of Adlai Stevenson and the putative hometown of Colonel Blake on MASH. It has a smaller twin city, Normal, that's built around a public university and is a whole different story. Both towns together are like 110,000 people. As Midwest cities go, the only remarkable thing about Bloomington is its prosperity. It is all but recession-proof. Some of this is due to the county's farmland, which is world-class fertile and so expensive per acre that a civilian can't even find out how much it costs. But Bloomington is also the national headquarters for State Farm, which is the great dark god of U.S. consumer insurance and for all practical purposes owns the town, and because of which Bloomington's east side is now all smoke glass complexes and build-to-suit developments and a six-lane beltway of malls and franchises that's killing off the old downtown, plus an ever-wider split between the town's two basic classes and cultures, so well and truly symbolized by the SUV and the pickup truck, respectively. Despite some people's impression, the native accent around here isn't Southern so much as just rural. The town's corporate transplants, on the other hand, have no accent at all. In Mrs. Bracero's phrase, State Farm people, quote, sound like the folks on TV. Winter here is a pitiless bitch, but in the warm months, Bloomington is a lot like a seaside community, except the ocean here is corn, which grows steroidically and stretches to the Earth's curve in all directions. The town itself in summer is intensely green, streets bathed in tree shade and homes explosive gardens and dozens of manicured parks and ball fields and golf courses you almost need eye protection to look at, and broad, weedless, fertilized lawns all made to line up exactly flush to the sidewalk with special edging tools. People here are deeply, deeply into lawn care. My own neighbors mow about as often as they shave. To be honest, it's all a little creepy, especially in high summer, when nobody's out and all that green just sits in the heat and seethes. Like most Midwest towns, Bloomington Normal is crammed with churches, 4 full pages in the phone book. Everything from Unitarian to bug-eyed Pentecostal. There's even a church for agnostics. But except for church, plus I guess your basic parades, fireworks, and a couple corn festivals, there isn't much public community. Everybody has his family and neighbors and tight little circle of friends. Folks keep to themselves. The native term for light conversation is visit. They basically all play softball or golf and grill out and watch their kids play soccer and sometimes go to mainstream movies. And they watch massive, staggering amounts of TV. I don't just mean the kids, either. Something that's obvious but important to keep in mind regarding Bloomington and the horror is that reality, any felt sense of a larger world, is mainly televisual. New York skyline, for instance, is as recognizable here as any place else, but what it's recognizable from is TV. TV's also a more social phenomenon than on the East Coast, where in my experience people are almost constantly leaving home to go meet other people face-to-face in public places. There don't really tend to be parties or mixers per se so much here. What you do in Bloomington is all get together at somebody's house and watch something. In Bloomington, therefore, to have a home without a TV is to become a kind of constant and Kramer-like presence in others' homes, a perpetual guest of folks who can't quite understand why somebody wouldn't own a TV but are totally respectful of your need to watch TV, and who will offer you access to their TV in the same instinctive way they'd bend down to lend a hand if you fell in the street. This is especially true for some kind of must-see, crisis-type situation like the 2000 election or this week's horror. All you have to do is call someone you know and say you don't have a TV. Well, shoot, boy. Get over here. Part 4. Tuesday. There are maybe 10 days a year when it's gorgeous in Bloomington, and September 11th is one of them. The air is clear and temperate and wonderfully dry after several weeks of what's felt very much like living in someone's armpit. It's just before serious harvesting starts, when the region's pollen is at its worst, and a good percentage of the city is stoned on Benadryl, which, as you probably know, tends to give the early morning a kind of dreamy, underwater quality. Time-wise, we're an hour behind the East Coast. By 8 o'clock, everybody with a job is at it, and just about everybody else is home drinking coffee and blowing their nose and watching Today or one of the other network AM shows that all broadcast, it goes without saying, from New York City. At 8 o'clock on Tuesday, I personally was in the shower, trying to listen to a Bears postmortem on WSCR Sports Radio in Chicago. The church I belong to is on the south side of Bloomington, near where my house is. Most of the people I know well enough to ask if I can come over and watch their TV are members of my church. It's not one of those churches where people throw Jesus' name around a lot or talk about the end times, but it's fairly serious, and people in the congregation get to know each other well and to be pretty tight. As far as I know, all the congregants are natives of the area. Most are working class or retired from same. There are some small business owners. A fair number are veterans and or have kids in the military or, especially, in the reserves, because for many of these families, that's what you do to pay for college. The house I end up sitting with shampoo in my hair watching most of the actual unfolding horror at belongs to Mrs. Thompson, who is one of the world's cooler 74-year-olds and exactly the kind of person who, in an emergency, even if her phone is busy, you know you can just come on over. She lives about a mile away from me on the other side of a mobile home park. The streets are not crowded, but they're also not as empty as they're going to get. Mrs. Thompson's is a tiny, immaculate, one-story home that on the West Coast would be called a bungalow and on the south side of Bloomington is called a house. Mrs. Thompson is a longtime member and a leader in the congregation, and her living room tends to be kind of a gathering place. She's also the mom of one of my very best friends here, F, who was in the Rangers in Vietnam and got shot in the knee and now works for a contractor installing various kinds of franchise stores in malls. He's in the middle of a divorce, long story, and living with Mrs. T while the court decides on the disposition of his house. F is one of those veterans who doesn't talk about the war or belong to the VFW, but is sometimes preoccupied in a haunted way and goes quietly off to camp by himself over Memorial Day weekend, and you can tell that he carries some serious shit in his head. Like most people who work construction, he wakes up very early and was long gone by the time I got to his mom's, which happened to be just after the second plane hit the South Tower, meaning probably around 8:10. In retrospect, the first sign of possible shock was the fact that I didn't ring the bell but just came on in, which normally here one would never do. Thanks in part to her son's trade connections, Mrs. T has a 40-inch flat-panel Philips TV on which Dan Rather appears for a second in shirt sleeves with his hair slightly mussed. People in Bloomington seem overwhelmingly to prefer CBS News. It's unclear why. Several other ladies from church are already over here, but I don't know if I exchanged greetings with anyone because I remember when I came in, everybody was staring transfixed at one of the very few pieces of video CBS never reran, which was a distant, wide-angle shot of the North Tower and its top floor's exposed steel lattice in flames, and of dots detaching from the building and moving through smoke down the screen, which then a sudden jerky tightening of the shot revealed to be actual people in coats and ties and skirts with their shoes falling off as they fell, some hanging onto ledges or girders and then letting go, upside down or wriggling as they fell, and one couple almost seeming, unverifiable, to be hugging each other as they fell those several stories and shrank back to dots as the camera then all of a sudden pulled back to the long view. I have no idea how long the clip took, after which Dan Rather's mouth seemed to move for a second before any sound emerged, and everyone in the room sat back and looked at one another with expressions that seemed somehow both childlike and terribly old. I think one or two people made some sort of sound. I'm not sure what else to say. It seems grotesque to talk about being traumatized by a piece of video when the people in the video were dying. Something about the shoes also falling made it worse. I think the older ladies took it better than I did. Then the hideous beauty of the rerun clip of the second plane hitting the tower, the blue and silver and black and spectacular orange of it as more little moving dots fell. Mrs. Thompson was in her chair, which is a rocker with floral cushions. The living room has two other chairs, and a huge corduroy sofa that F and I had to take the front door off its hinges to get in the house. All the seats were occupied, meaning I think five or six other people, most women, all these over 50, and there were more voices in the kitchen, one of which was very upset-sounding and belonged to the psychologically delicate Mrs. R., who I don't know very well but is said to have once been a beauty of great local repute. Many of the people are Mrs. T's neighbors, some are still in robes, and at various times people leave to go home and use the phone and come back, or leave altogether. One younger lady went to go take her children out of school, and then other people came. At one point, around the time the South Tower was falling so perfectly seeming down into itself, I remember thinking that it was falling the way an elegant lady faints, but it was Mrs. Bracero's normally pretty much useless and irritating son, Duane, who pointed out that what it really looked like is if you took some film of a NASA liftoff and ran it backwards, which now, after several reviewings, does seem dead on. There were at least a dozen people in the house. The living room was dim because in summer here, everyone always keeps their drapes pulled. Mrs. Thompson's living room is prototypical working-class Bloomington, too. Double-pane windows, white Sears curtains with valance, catalog clock with a background of mallards, wood-grain magazine rack with Christian Science Monitor and Reader's Digest, inset bookshelves used to display little collectible figurines and framed photos of relatives and their families. There are two knit samplers with the Desiderata and Prayer of St. Francis, antimacassars on every good chair, and wall-to-wall carpet so thick that you can't see your feet. People take their shoes off at the door. It's basic common courtesy. Is it normal not to remember things very well after only a couple days, or at any rate the order of things? I know at some point for a while there was the sound outside of some neighbor mowing his lawn, which seemed totally bizarre, but I don't remember if anybody remarked on it. Sometimes it seemed like nobody said anything, and sometimes like everybody was talking at once. There was also a lot of telephonic activity. None of these women carry cell phones. Duane has a pager whose function is unclear, so it's just Mrs. T's old wall mount in the kitchen. Not all the calls made rational sense. One side effect of the horror was an overwhelming desire to call everyone you loved. It was established early on that you couldn't get New York. Dialing 212 yielded only a weird whooping sound. People keep asking Mrs. T's permission until she tells them to knock it off and for heaven's sake just use the phone. Some of the ladies reach their husbands, who are apparently all gathered around TVs and radios at their various workplaces. For a while, bosses are too shocked to think to send people home. Mrs. T has coffee on, but another sign of crisis is that if you want some, you have to get it yourself. Usually it just sort of appears. From the door to the kitchen, I remember seeing the second tower fall and being confused about whether it was a replay of the first tower falling. Another thing about the hay fever is that you can't ever be totally sure someone's crying. But over the 2 hours of first-run horror, with bonus reports of the crash in Pennsylvania and Bush being moved into a sack bunker and a car bomb that's gone off in Chicago, the latter then retracted, pretty much everybody either cries or comes very close, according to his or her relative abilities. Mrs. Thompson says less than almost anyone. I don't think she cries, but she doesn't rock in her chair as usual either. Her first husband's death was apparently sudden and grisly, and I know at times during the war, F would be out in the field and she wouldn't hear from him for weeks at a time and didn't know whether he was even alive. Duane Bracero's main contribution is to keep iterating how much like a movie it all seems. Duane, who's at least 25 but still lives at home while supposedly studying to be a welder, is one of these people who always wears camouflage t-shirts and paratrooper boots but would never dream of actually enlisting, as, to be fair, neither would I. He has also kept his hat, the front of which promotes something called slipknot, on his head indoors in Mrs. Thompson's house. It always seems to be important to have at least one person in the vicinity to hate. It turns out the cause of poor tendony Mrs. R's meltdown in the kitchen is that she has either a grandniece or removed cousin who's doing some type of internship at Time Incorporated in the Time Life Building or whatever it's called, about which Mrs. R and whoever she's managed to call know only that it's a vertiginously tall skyscraper someplace in New York City, and she's out of her mind with worry. And two other ladies have been out here the whole time holding both her hands and trying to decide whether they should call her doctor. Mrs. R has kind of a history. And I end up doing pretty much the only good I do all day by explaining to Mrs. R where Midtown Manhattan is. It thereupon emerges that none of the people here I'm watching the horror with, not even the couple ladies who'd gone to see Cats as part of some group tour thing through the church in 1991, have even the vaguest notion of New York's layout and don't know, for example, how radically far south the Financial District and Statue of Liberty are. They have to be shown this via pointing out the ocean in the foreground of the skyline they all know so well from TV. The half-assed little geography lesson is the start of a feeling of alienation from these good people that builds in me all throughout the part of the horror where people flee rubble and dust. These ladies are not stupid or ignorant. Mrs. Thompson can read both Latin and Spanish, and Ms. Voigtlander is a certified speech therapist who once explained to me that the strange gulping sound that makes NBC's Tom Brokaw so distracting to listen to is an actual speech impediment called a glottal L. It was one of the ladies out in the kitchen supporting Mrs. R who pointed out that September 11th is the anniversary of the Camp David Accords, which was certainly news to me. What these Bloomington ladies are, or start to seem to me, is innocent. There is what would strike many Americans as a marked, startling lack of cynicism in the room. It does not, for instance, occur to anyone here to remark on how it's maybe a little odd that all three network anchors are in shirt sleeves, or to consider the possibility that Dan Rather's hairs being mussed might not be wholly accidental, or that the constant rerunning of horrific footage might not be just in case some viewers were just now tuning in and hadn't seen it yet. None of the ladies seem to notice the president's odd little lightless eyes appear to get closer and closer together throughout his taped address, nor that some of his lines sound almost plagiaristically identical to those uttered by Bruce Willis as a right-wing wacko, recall, in The Siege a couple years back, nor that at least some of the sheer weirdness of watching the horror unfold has been how closely various shots and scenes have mirrored the plots of everything from Die Hard 1 through 3 to Air Force 1. Nobody's near hip enough to lodge the sick and obvious postmodern complaint, "We've seen this before." Instead, what they do is all sit together and feel really bad, and pray. No one in Mrs. Thompson's circle would ever be so nauseous as to try to get everybody to pray aloud or form a prayer circle, but you can still tell what they're all doing. Make no mistake, this is mostly a good thing. It forces you to think and do things you most likely wouldn't alone, like for instance while watching the address and eyes to pray, silently and fervently, that you're wrong about the president, that your view of him is maybe distorted and he's actually far smarter and more substantial than you believe. Not just some soulless golem or nexus of corporate interest dressed up in a suit, but a statesman of courage and probity. And it's good, this is good to pray this way. It's just a bit lonely to have to. Truly decent, innocent people can be taxing to be around. I'm not for a moment trying to suggest that everyone I know in Bloomington is like Mrs. Thompson. Her son F isn't, though he's an outstanding person. I'm trying, rather, to explain how some part of the horror was knowing, deep in my heart, that whatever America the men in those planes hated so much was far more my America, and F's, and poor old loathsome Duane's, than it was these ladies. Big Red Sun. Quick note here, there's a first-person plural pronoun that gets used throughout. This piece was originally published bi-pseudonymously for weird reasons, and for equally weird reasons, it really can't be changed now. So that's why the we and your correspondent stuff. The American Academy of Emergency Medicine confirms it. Each year, between 1 and 2 dozen adult U.S. males are admitted to emergency rooms after having castrated themselves, with kitchen tools usually, sometimes wire cutters. In answer to the obvious question, surviving patients most often report that their sexual urges had become a source of intolerable conflict and anxiety. The desire for perfect release and the real-world impossibility of perfect whenever-you-want-it release had together produced a tension they could no longer stand. It is to the 30-plus testosteronically afflicted males whose cases have been documented in the past 2 years that your correspondents wish to dedicate this article. And to those tormented souls considering autocastration in 1998, we wish to say, stop. Stay your hand. Hold off with those kitchen utensils and or wire cutters. Because we believe we may have found an alternative. Every spring, the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences presents awards for outstanding achievement in all aspects of mainstream cinema. These are the Academy Awards. Mainstream cinema is a major industry in the United States, and so are the Academy Awards. The awards' notorious commercialism and hypocrisy disgust many of the millions and millions and millions of viewers who tune in during prime time to watch the presentations. It is not a coincidence that the Oscars ceremony is held during TV's Sweeps Week. We pretty much all tune in, despite the grotesquerie of watching an industry congratulate itself on its pretense that it's still an art form, of hearing people in $5,000 gowns invoke lush cliches of surprise and humility scripted by publicists, etc., the whole cynical postmodern deal. But we all still seem to watch, to care, even though the hypocrisy hurts. Even though opening grosses and marketing strategies are now bigger news than the movies themselves, even though Cannes and Sundance have become nothing more than enterprise zones. But the truth is that there's no more real joy about it all anymore. Worse, there seems to be this enormous unspoken conspiracy where we all pretend that there's still joy. That we think it's funny when Bob Dole does a Visa ad and Gorbachev shills for Pizza Hut. That the whole mainstream celebrity culture is rushing to cash in and all the while congratulating itself on pretending not to cash in. Underneath it all, though, we know the whole thing sucks. Your correspondents humbly offer an alternative. Every January, the least pretentious city in America hosts the annual AVN Awards. The AVN stands for Adult Video News, which is sort of the variety of the U.S. porn industry. This thick, expensively designed magazine costs $7.95 per issue, is about 80% ads, and is clearly targeted at adult video retailers. Its circulation is approximately 40,000. Though the subline vagaries of entertainment accounting are legendary, it is universally acknowledged that the U.S. adult film industry, at $3.5 to $4 billion in annual sales, rentals, cable charges, and video masturbation booth revenues, is an even larger and more efficient money-making machine than legitimate mainstream American cinema, the latter's annual gross commonly estimated at $2 to $2.5 billion. The U.S. adult industry is centered in L.A.'s San Fernando Valley, just over the mountains from Hollywood. One porn production company, Caballero Home Video, has its headquarters in a big Van Nuys duplex whose other half is the soundstage for Beverly Hills 90210. Some insiders like to refer to the adult industry as Hollywood's evil twin, others as the mainstream's big red sun. It is no accident that Adult Video News, a slick, expensive periodical whose articles are really more like infomercials, and its yearly awards both came into being in 1982. The early 80s, after all, saw the genesis of VCRs and home video rentals, which have done for the adult industry pretty much what TV did for pro football. From the December 11, 1997 press release issued by AVN, everything that follows is a quotation, and by the way, it's verbatim. Quote, "The nominations for the 15th annual AVN Awards were announced today. The passive mood here is a bit disingenuous. The release itself is announcing them. This year's awards show, commemorating AVN's 15th anniversary, celebrates history. Awards will be presented in a record 106 categories over a two-night period. The adult industry released nearly 8,000 adult releases in 1997, including over 4,000 new releases, non-compilation. AVN reviewed every new release in every, and this is verbatim, category this past year, logging over 30,000 sex scenes. At, say, an average of 90 minutes per movie, this means that some person or persons put in 1.4 years of nonstop continuous porn viewing. Hence your correspondent's alternative for U.S. males so tortured by carnal desire that they are tempted to auto-neuter. Volunteer as a judge for the AVN Awards and spend 1.4 years gazing without rest at the latest in adult video. We guarantee that you will never thereafter want to see, hear, engage in, or even think about human sexuality ever again. Trust us on this." All five marginal and male print journalists assigned to cover the 1998 AVN Awards concur. Even just watching the dozen or so big or high-profile adult releases of the past year, Bad Wives, Zazel, A Week and a Half in the Life of a Prostitute, Miscreants, New Wave Hookers 5, Seduce and Destroy, Butt Man in Barcelona, Gluteus to the Maximus, fried everyone's glandular circuit board. By the end of the awards weekend, none of us were even having normal biological first thing in the morning or jouncy bus ride between hotels erections. And when approached even innocently by members of the opposite sex, we all now recoiled as from a hot flame, which made our party a kind of strange and challenging breakfast gig, according to our Sunday morning waitress. Still quoting here, "By comparison, last year there were approximately 375 films eligible for the Academy Awards that these voters, meaning different voters from the AVN voters, presumably, were required to see. AVN had to watch more than 10 times the amount of releases in order to develop these nominations. Usage and repetition here are verbatim again, though 4,000 divided by 375 is indeed over 10. Close quote. From the acceptance speech of Mr. Tom Byron, Saturday, January 10, 1998, Caesars Forum Ballroom, Caesars Palace Hotel and Casino Complex, Las Vegas, Nevada. Upon winning AVN's 1998 Male Performer of the Year Award, and with no little feeling, quote, "I want to thank every beautiful woman I ever put my cock inside," close quote. Laughter, cheers, ovation. From the acceptance speech of Ms. Gina Fine, Ibid, upon winning AVN's 1998 Best Supporting Actress Award for her role in Rob Black's Miscreants, quote, "Jesus, which one is this for? Miscreants? Jesus, that's another one where I read the script and said, oh shit, I am going to go to hell." Laughter, cheers. "But that's okay, because all my friends will be there too." Huge wave of laughter, cheers, applause. From the inter-award banter of Mr. Bobby Slayton, professional comedian and master of ceremonies for the 1997 AVNAs. Quote, "I know I'm looking good though, like younger, because I started using this special Grecian formula. Every time I find a gray hair, I fuck my wife in the ass. no laughter, scattered groans. Fuck you. That's a great joke. Close quote. Bobby Slayton, a gravelly-voiced Dice Clay knockoff who kept introducing every female performer as the woman I'm going to cut my dick off for, and who astounded all the marginal print journalists in attendance with both his unfunniness and his resemblance to every apartment complex coke dealer we'd ever met, is mercifully absent from the 1998 awards gala. The 98 MC is one Robert Schimmel, alumnus of In Living Color and a Howard Stern regular. Schimmel looks like a depraved, deeply tan Wallace Shawn, and is no less coarse than Bobby Slayton, but a lot better. He does a pantomime of someone attempting intercourse with a love doll he's been too lazy to blow up all the way. He contrasts the woeful paucity of his own ejaculate with the concussive orgasms of certain well-known male performers. Mr. Peter North, in particular, delivers what seem more like mortar rounds than bioemissions. Comparing these men's ejaculations to automatic lawn sprinklers and doing an eerie sonic impression of same. All of 1998's marginal print journalists are together at table 189 at the very back of the ballroom. Most of these reporters are from the sorts of men's magazines that sit shrink-wrapped behind the cash registers of convenience stores, and they are a worldly and jaded crew indeed. But Schimmel gets a couple of them, whose noms de guerre are Harold Hecuba and Dick Filth, laughing so uproariously that people at the anabolic video table nearby keep looking over in annoyance. At one point during a routine on premature ejaculation, Dick Filth actually chokes on a California roll. But all this is Saturday night, the main event, and there are a whole lot of festivities preceding Saturday's climax. The adult industry is vulgar. Would anyone disagree? One of the AVN Awards categories is Best Anal-Themed Feature. Another is Best Overall Marketing Campaign, Company Image. Irresistible, a 1983 winner in several categories, has been misspelled irresistable in adult video news for 15 straight years. The industry's not only vulgar, it's predictably vulgar. All the clichés are true. The typical porn producer really is the ugly little man with a bad toupee and a pinky ring the size of a Rolaids. The typical porn director really is the guy who uses the word class as a noun to mean refinement. The typical porn starlet really is the lady in Lycra evening wear with tattoos all down her arms, who's both smoking and chewing gum while telling journalists how grateful she is to Wadcutter Productions Limited for footing her breast enlargement bill. And meaning it. The whole AVN Awards weekend comprises what Mr. Dick Filth calls an irony-free zone. But of course, we should keep in mind that the word vulgar has many dictionary definitions, and that only a couple of these have to do with lewdness or bad taste. At root, vulgar just means popular on a mass scale. It is the semantic opposite of pretentious or snobby. It is humility with a comb-over. It is Nielsen ratings and Barnum's axiom and the real bottom line. It is big, big business. 34-year-old porn actor Cal Jammer killed himself in 1995. Starlets Shauna Grant, Nancy Kelly, Alex Jordan, and Savannah have all killed themselves in the last decade. Savannah and Jordan received AVN's Best New Starlet Awards in 1991 and 1992, respectively. Savannah killed herself after getting mildly disfigured in a car accident. Alex Jordan is famous for having addressed her suicide note to her pet bird. Crewman and performer Israel Gonzalez killed himself at a porn company warehouse in 1997. An LA-based support group called PAW, meaning Protecting Adult Welfare, runs a 24-hour crisis line for people in the adult industry. A fundraiser for PAW was held at a Mission Hills, California bowling alley last November. It was a nude bowling tournament. Dozens of starlets agreed to take part. 200 or 300 adult video fans showed up and paid to watch them bowl naked. No production companies or their executives participated or gave money. The fundraiser took in $6,000, which is slightly less than 2/1,000,000ths of porn's yearly gross. As you know, if you've seen Casino, Showgirls, Bugsy, etc., there are really three Las Vegases. Binion's, where the World Series of Poker is always played, exemplifies the Old Vegas, centered around Fremont Street. Las Vegas's future is even now under late-stage construction at the very end of the Strip, on the outskirts of town, where U.S. malls always go up. It's to be a bunch of theme parkish, more family-oriented venues of the kind that De Niro describes so plangently at the end of Casino. But Las Vegas, as most of us see it, Vegas qua Vegas, comprises the dozen or so hotels that flank the strip's middle. Vegas Populi, the opulent, intricate, garish, ecstatically decadent hotels, cathedra to gambling, partying, and live entertainment of the most microphone-swinging sort. The Sands, the Sahara, the Stardust, MGM Grand, Maxim, all within a small radius. Yearly utility expenditures on neon well into seven figures. Harrah's, Casino Royale, with its big 24-hour Denny's attached. Flamingo Hilton, Imperial Palace. The Mirage, with its huge laddered walk.